Chapter 33. View that Madame Olenska would be better off as an unhappy wife than as a separated one, and that there was no use in discussing the case with Newland, who had an awkward way of suddenly not seeming to take the most fundamental things for granted. Archer looked up and met his visitor's anxious gaze. Don't you know, monsieur, is it possible you don't know that the family begin to doubt if they have the right to advise the Countess to refuse her husband's last proposals? The proposals you brought? The proposals I brought. It was on Archer's lips to exclaim that whatever he knew or did not know was no concern of M. Riviere's, but something in the humble and yet courageous tenacity of M. Riviere's gaze made him reject this conclusion, and he met the young man's question with another. What is your object in speaking to me of this? He had not to wait a moment for the answer. Oh, beg you, monsieur, to beg you with all the force I'm capable of not to let her go back. Oh, don't let her! M. Riviere exclaimed. Archer looked at him with increasing astonishment. There was no mistaking the sincerity of his distress, or the strength of his determination. He had evidently resolved to let everything go by the board, but the supreme need of thus putting himself on record. Archer considered. May I ask, he said at length, if this is the line you took with the Countess Olenska? M. Riviere reddened, but his eyes did not falter. No, monsieur. I accepted my mission in good faith. I really believed, for reasons I need not trouble you with, that it would be better for Madame Olenska to recover her situation, her fortune, the social consideration that her husband's standing gives her. So I supposed. You could hardly have accepted such a mission otherwise. I should not have accepted it. Well, then, Archer paused again, and their eyes met in another protracted scrutiny. Ah, monsieur, after I had seen her, after I had listened to her, I knew she was better off here. You knew, monsieur, I discharged my mission faithfully. I put the Count's arguments, I stated his offers, without adding any comment of my own. The Countess was good enough to listen patiently. She carried her goodness so far as to see me twice. She considered impartially all I had come to say. And it was in the course of these two talks that I changed my mind, that I came to see things differently. May I ask what led to this change? Simply seeing the change in her, M. Riviere replied. The change in her? Then you knew her before? The young man's color again rose. Used to see her in her husband's house. I have known Count Olenski for many years. You can imagine that he would not have sent a stranger on such a mission. Archer's gaze, wandering away to the blank walls of the office, rested on a hanging calendar surmounted by the rugged features of the President of the United States. That such a conversation should be going on anywhere within the millions of square miles subject to his rule seemed as strange as anything that the imagination could invent. The change, what sort of a change? Ah, monsieur, if I could tell you. M. Riviere paused. Tennis the discovery, I suppose, of what I'd never thought of before. That she's an American. And that if you're an American of her kind, of your kind, things that are accepted in certain other societies, or at least put up with as part of a general convenient give-and-take become unthinkable, simply unthinkable. If Madame Olenska's relations understood what these things were, their opposition to her returning would no doubt be as unconditional as her own. But they seem to regard her husband's wish to have her back as proof of an irresistible longing for domestic life. M. Riviere paused, and then added, "Whereas it's far from being as simple as that." Archer looked back to the President of the United States, and then down at his desk, and at the papers scattered on it. For a second or two he could not trust himself to speak. During this interval he heard M. Riviere's chair pushed back, and was aware that the young man had risen. When he glanced up again he saw that his visitor was as moved as himself. "Thank you," Archer said simply. "There's nothing to thank me for, monsieur. It is I, rather," M. Riviere broke off, as if speech for him too were difficult. Should like, though, he continued in a firmer voice, to add one thing. You asked me if I was in Count Olenski's employ. I am at this moment. I returned to him a few months ago for reasons of private necessity, such as may happen to anyone who has persons, ill and older persons, dependent on him. But from the moment that I have taken the step of coming here to say these things to you, I consider myself discharged, and I shall tell him so on my return, and give him the reasons. That's all, monsieur. M. Riviere bowed, and drew back a step. Thank you, Archer said again, as their hands met. XXVI. Every year on the 15th of October, Fifth Avenue opened its shutters, unrolled its carpets, and hung up its triple layer of window curtains. By the 1st of November, this household ritual was over, and society had begun to look about and take stock of itself. By the 15th, the season was in full blast. Opera and theaters were putting forth their new attractions, dinner engagements were accumulating, and dates for dances being fixed. And punctually at about this time, Mrs. Archer always said that New York was very much changed. Observing it from the lofty standpoint of a non-dash participant, she was able, with the help of Mr. Sillerton Jackson and Miss Sophie, to trace each new crack in its surface, and all the strange weeds pushing up between the ordered rows of social vegetables. It had been one of the amusements of Archer's youth to wait for this annual pronouncement of his mother's, and to hear her enumerate the minute signs of disintegration that his careless gaze had overlooked. For New York, to Mrs. Archer's mind, never changed without changing for the worse, and in this view Miss Sophie Jackson heartily concurred. Mr. Sillerton Jackson, as became a man of the world, suspended his judgment and listened with an amused impartiality to the lamentations of the ladies. But even he never denied that New York had changed, and Newland Archer, in the winter of the second year of his marriage, was himself obliged to admit that, if it had not actually changed, it was certainly changing. These points had been raised, as usual, at Mrs. Archer's Thanksgiving dinner. At the date when she was officially enjoined to give thanks for the blessings of the year, it was her habit to take a mournful, though not embittered, stock of her world, and wonder what there was to be thankful for. At any rate, not the state of society. Society, if it could be said to exist, was rather a spectacle on which to call down biblical imprecations, and in fact, everyone knew what the Reverend Dr. Ashmore meant when he chose a text from Jeremiah, chapter 1, verse 25, for his Thanksgiving sermon. Dr. Ashmore, the new rector of St. Matthew's, had been chosen because he was very advanced. His sermons were considered bold in thought and novel in language. When he fulminated against fashionable society, he always spoke of its end, and to Mrs. Archer it was terrifying, and yet fascinating, to feel herself part of a community that was trending. There's no doubt that Dr. Ashmore is right. There is a marked trend, she said, as if it were something visible and measurable, like a crack in a house. It was odd, though, to preach about it on Thanksgiving, Miss Jackson opined, and her hostess dryly rejoined. He means us to give thanks for what's left. Archer had been wont to smile at these annual vaticinations of his mother's, but this year even he was obliged to acknowledge, as he listened to an enumeration of the changes, that their end was visible. The extravagance in dress, Miss Jackson began. Sillerton took me to the first night of the opera, and I can only tell you that Jane Mary's dress was the only one I recognized from last year, and even that it had the front panel changed. Yet I know she got it out from Worth only 2 years ago, because my seamstress always goes in to make over her Paris dresses before she wears them. Ah, Jane Mary is one of us, said Mrs. Archer sighing, as if it were not such an enviable thing to be in an age when ladies were beginning to flaunt abroad their Paris dresses as soon as they were out of the custom house, instead of letting them mellow under lock and key, in the manner of Mrs. Archer's contemporaries. Yes, She's one of the few. In my youth, Miss Jackson rejoined, it was considered vulgar to dress in the newest fashions. And Amy Sillerton has always told me that in Boston the rule was to put away one's Paris dresses for 2 years. Old Mrs. Baxter Penlow, who did everything handsomely, used to import 12 a year, 2 velvet, 2 satin, 2 silk, and the other 6 of poplin and the finest cashmere. It was a standing order, and as she was ill for 2 years, before she died they found 48 worth dresses that had never been taken out of tissue paper, and when the girls left off their mourning they were able to wear the first lot at the symphony concerts without looking in advance of the fashion. Ah, well, Boston is more conservative than New York, but I always think it's a safe rule for a lady to lay aside her French dresses for one season, Mrs. Archer conceded. It was Beaufort who started the new fashion, by making his wife clap her new clothes on her back, as soon as they arrived. I must say at times it takes all Regina's distinction not to look like. Miss Jackson glanced around the table, caught Janie's bulging gaze, and took refuge in an unintelligible murmur. Like her rivals, said Mr. Sillerton Jackson, with the air of producing an epigram. Oh, the ladies murmured. And Mrs. Archer added, partly to distract her daughter's attention from forbidden topics. Poor Regina. Her Thanksgiving hasn't been a very cheerful one, I'm afraid. Have you heard the rumors about Beaufort's speculations, Sillerton? Mr. Jackson nodded carelessly. Everyone had heard the rumors in question, and he scorned to confirm a tale that was already common property. A gloomy silence fell upon the party. No one really liked Beaufort, and it was not wholly unpleasant to think the worst of his private life, but the idea of his having brought financial dishonor on his wife's family was too shocking to be enjoyed even by his enemies. Archer's New York tolerated hypocrisy in private relations, but in business matters it exacted a limpid and impeccable honesty. It was a long time since any well-known banker had failed discreditably, but everyone remembered the social extinction visited on the heads of the firm when the last event of the kind had happened. It would be the same with the Beauforts, in spite of his power and her popularity. Not all the leaked strength of the Dallas connection would save poor Regina if there were any truth in the reports of her husband's unlawful speculations. The talk took refuge in less ominous topics, but everything they touched on seemed to confirm Mrs. Archer's sense of an accelerated trend. Of course, Newland, I know you let dear May go to Mrs. Struther's Sunday evenings, she began, and May interposed gaily. H, you know, everybody goes to Mrs. Struther's now, and she was invited to Granny's last reception. It was thus, Archer reflected, that New York managed its transitions, conspiring to ignore them till they were well over, and then, in all good faith, imagining that they had taken place in a preceding age. There was always a traitor in the Citadel. And after he or generally she had surrendered the keys, what was the use of pretending that it was impregnable? Once people had tasted of Mrs. Struther's easy Sunday hospitality, they were not likely to sit at home remembering that her champagne was transmuted shoe polish. I know, dear, I know, Mrs. Archer sighed. Such things have to be, I suppose, as long as amusement is what people go out for. But I've never quite forgiven your cousin Madame Olenska for being the first person to countenance Mrs. Struther's. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.